Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. This week we have author Jim Musgrave. He's the author of the Pat O'Malley Historical Mystery Series, and he has a new novel called Forevermore. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Sherry. Nice to meet you again.
Nice to meet you. Well, we saw each other in person, too, so that was cool.
Right.
Please tell us a bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I taught college composition for over 20 years, and it was just long enough to make me believe in the grammar fairy. Everybody, you know, believes in the tooth fairy, but there is a grammar fairy. That actually evolved after my retirement into a small editing business my wife and I put together. She's also a retired English teacher, English professor. I've also worked at a variety of other jobs in my other life, civilian jobs, I like to call it, because working for the state, you know, it's kind of like a government job. But I worked at Caltech, a private university in Pasadena, home of the Big Bang Theory. And I also wrote TV news, quite a bit different type of news writing. And I was an editor for a few educational and trade publications in the L.A. area for a while. I'm married to Ellen. She's the retired college professor, as well as I. And we live in San Diego, as you know. And I have two children from a previous marriage, as Ellen does, and they are all grown and sprinkled around California like, you know, dandelion spores. California's like that. It's really big, a lot of places to land.
Oh, yeah, definitely. What did you mean by grammar fairy? I don't get that reference.
Well, whenever you tell people you teach English, whether you're a professor or just an English teacher in K through 12, people suddenly, you know, wish that they'd learned their grammar, I suppose. They think you teach grammar, and that's about it. So I always talk about the grammar fairy being real and that they'll visit them, you know, if they...
they're good?
If they're good, yeah.
Good
no, and then I give. Yeah, you got to learn grammar. You know, you're supposed to have learned it in K through 12, but it's getting more difficult. Students are coming in, especially community colleges, without any skills, so they have to start over with the grammar. They don't teach them in K through 12.
I never heard that terminology before, grammar fairy. Did you create that?
I wish I had a math fairy. I wasn't too good in math. You weren't either, were you?
No, I sucked at math. That was not one of my best subjects. I had, we had a private talk, and my brother even mentioned to you, because I had the worst of the teachers in our school for math. I did not have the luck of the draw.
Yeah, I wasn't very good either. But thank goodness we were good in English, right?
Yes, exactly. Tell us about, do you have a love of history? Is that part of what your stories are about? Because I know the latest one is about Poe. And you also do steampunk, which is Victorian. So I just wondered... does that have a part in your writing?
Oh, yes. We were kind of discussing yesterday at the artists group and meet, and Steve Allen was a guy who introduced me when I was very young, watching TV.
He was amazing.
And his great historical... television, you know, You Are There, and that really spurred my interest because I saw that history is really a living can become a living quality and reality. And so when I realized that, I started reading more history and becoming involved. And now that I'm an author, I believe that, you know, with the internet, I believe an author is crazy not to, you know, get involved with historical characters and facts. For example, I use a little application that's called the Google Ngram Viewer. And what this does for the author, little tidbit for the authors who are listening, it gives the word that you put in, the search word, and it lets you know whether it was used in the time period you're writing in. In other words, I write in the post-Civil War era in New York City. So I was looking up a word for my third novel in the trilogy that I completed, the Pat O'Malley. I was looking up the word gonorrhea to see whether it was used, and sure enough, they used that term. But not the word chlamydia, which is more modern disease and term, I suppose. And no, chlamydia is not a dip made from clams. But anyway.
Yuck. Really yuck.
Right. It's a bad disease.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was pulled into the 1860s as a setting for the mysteries because it was a time that was so impressively corrupt. Only today's Wall Street grubs could compare with the ones in New York City in the 1860s. And they had Tammany Hall and William Boss Tweed, and it's a time when Grandma took her opiate laudanum as medicine, and she was found whacked out behind the coal stove because opiates, cocaine, and marijuana were sold over the counter. I like to say that the 1860s were like the 1960s without the rock and roll, but they had Stephen Foster. Sex was the second biggest industry in New York City behind the garment workers. And the Oneida perfectionist Christian communes believed in sharing all property and wives equally.
Yeah, really?
So,
interesting.
So the 1860s were pretty cool.
You were talking about patent medicine. Is that what you're talking about? How people kind of donked?
Yeah, I mean, it was all legal to put these ingredients, you know, into the products, and they were doing so, and they were getting results, obviously, since many of the drugs are on our, you know, banned substance list today.
It's funny because I remember reading that Coca-Cola was actually a patent medicine, and there was real Coke in it. I don't know if that's an urban legend, but I thought that was
No, that's very true. Yeah, in the 1860s it was being used. And, of course, they fought the war in China, you know, the Opium War, because it was such a big business in Europe and the United States. Opium products were really big.
They were like the drug wars for heroin and cocaine today.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it just changes hands, you know what I mean? It doesn't go away. I mean, once you have addictive substances, they just kind of change hands and become, you know, used by different political and or illegal parties.
Interesting. Does that have a part in your series or your one of your stories that you're using that for that period?
Yeah, especially the third book. Yeah, the third book gets into not only drug use but prostitution in New York City. It's kind of a I was just reading today, as a matter of fact, they busted like a worldwide network of, you know, they were used, had child prostitutes.
Yeah, that was a huge one, yeah.
So I wanted to kind of, with the third book, Jane the Grabber, she was a notorious madam in New York City. There were a lot of them. I wanted to make her a villain, and I wanted to contrast her with my kind of partner of my sleuth, who's also a madam, but she runs her houses, you know, with a doctor who inspects her ladies, and she gives her ladies more freedom, you know. So my Becky Charming is her name. Mm-hmm. Is kind of contrasted in the third novel with this villain, Jane the Grabber, and I kind of use historical character. Not a lot of information about this woman, but I had enough to turn her into a real baddie. So I had a lot of fun writing that. And there's a transition in the novel where she becomes basically, you know, a supernatural time traveler, this villain, and that's how she's able to create her big business, which is trafficking in orphan children in New York.
Wow.
And so that's what O'Malley...
It sounds really scary.
Yeah, she is. I even invent kind of a fairy tale machine that the kids... They say, you know, don't go in the room where there's the huff and puff machine, that the kids call it, because kids who go into the hotel rooms, you know, as child prostitutes never return. You know, so there's kind of I kind of plant that at the beginning, you know, this kind of Grimm's fairy tale story about this huff and puff machine, which is really a kind of a steampunk device, you know, that we find out at the end of the novel is not too great.
Yes, doesn't it sound like one of the, like my nice travel, time travel machine, or H.G. Wells' nice travel machine.
Yeah.
It's a bad time travel machine.
That's right. They can, I mean, it can work for good or evil, as we say. Devices are always open for nefarious uses.
What kind of books do you personally like to read? What do you have favorites? Do you have the genre you prefer?
Yeah, I started reading some steampunk, and they even have mysteries. So I was kind of hooking on to some of those recently. But I think, you know, I'm kind of, if I were to mix two people or two writers, authors of stuff that I read, I would go with, like, Edgar Allan Kafka would be one author.
Interesting.
To study, you know, for as a writer, for technique, and throw in a little Henry James, you know, turn of the screw, you know, the kind of idea that sometimes less is more in when you're writing psychological suspense. And I guess also Chekhov, you know, for realism and kind of showing everyday people, and especially writing technique, you know, he was able to, you know, create a scene and have the characters drive the plot rather than kind of an author who manipulates characters.
Do you, do you have a favorite of those novels, or are you just like,
favorite novel? Oh,
you,
wow.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, aren't you stumped when people ask you that, being a reader, you know, voracious?
I am a voracious reader. I have favorites in different genres, so it depends what you're asking me. Like,
right.
I like I love, for mysteries, I'm a big Agatha Christie reader. I like Dorothy Sayers. I like Arthur Conan Doyle. But if you're talking science fiction, it's Ray Bradbury. I mean, it depends on the genre you're talking in.
That's right.
So
yeah,
that's how I break it down.
Right. I guess mysteries would have to be guys like Lawrence Block. In fact, he wrote a book that kind of helped me along on the path of mystery writing. It's called Telling Lies for Fun and Profit. I was hooked on the title.
It's a funny
and
title.
And then I got into it. Yeah. And he gives a lot of, you know, nuts and bolts suggestions, and that's what I really appreciated. Even more than Stephen King's book, you know, on writing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Stephen really gives a lot of nuts and bolts stuff that, you know, writers who aspire to be professionals want to hear. And I guess, you know, so, and I really enjoyed Stephen King. Before my father died, we used to share books, you know, swap Lawrence Block mysteries, so it was fun.
Was your dad a big influence on you to become a reader?
Not really. In fact, I would say, and I, you know, if I were to do a doctoral thesis, I might get into this more, but I think because of my parents' divorce and being forced into some spots that a child shouldn't be forced into, I think I turned to literature as an escape from dysfunction, at least reading, and because I had no encouragement in the family, the immediate family, because it was in such turmoil, alcoholic parent, and so... libraries became my solace. You know, it's like I would run to the library when there's a big fight or, you know, something going on in the family. And I think, you know, I kind of learned on my own. I was an autodidact, I think the term is.
Did you like to, well, like when I was a little girl, I used to escape into stories, especially if it had, like, foreign places that I'd never heard of. I got to the point where I would, like, Daddy, what is, where can I get a book on Japan? Because I saw it in a TV show or a movie, and he's like, they used to have something called bookmobiles that they don't have anymore.
Ah.
Wait for them to come that weekend, and we'd look through all the books, and we'd get something that I was interested in. I missed those. They were fun. It was like the ice cream man. You ran for it.
That's right. Yeah, my teachers kind of took on the role of my literary escorts. You know, they would turn me on to different books and things like that. But I did a lot of searching on my own, which can be good and bad. But I think I discovered a lot of authors maybe I wouldn't have discovered without using my personal Montessori method of searching. Swimming through the stacks, I think that was a J.D. Salinger line that I used to like. You know, you just kind of swim and pick out one. And...
Well, I like that. I actually really enjoy that, that you go to the bookstore or the library and you just kind of like wander and you see something looks interesting, you pick it up, you start to read it. Okay, I'll get that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not recommended, it's not something you're required to do, it's there and you're like, oh, and then you get hooked and then you want to read everything about that. That's how you get hooked on reading. I mean, at least that's how it happened for me.
Yeah, I think you don't get hooked the wrong way, which today I think happens a lot, you know, through sales device, gimmickry, you know, all the 1,500, you know, glowing reviews from every corner of the world, and then you read the book, and it's basically schlock. Wow, all those people liked that book? I don't know.
But I'd rather, like, find it on my own. That's more fun.
Yeah. I mean, how intimate can you get, you know, the intimacy between the writer and the reader?
Yeah, exactly.
Let them make up their own minds.
Precisely. Give us a taste of your current book that's out now, and just a taste. Tell us what it's about and what you'd like the readers to take away from it.
Okay. You know, I was thinking about this, and I was wondering if I could maybe give you some plot summaries of the next four novels that are really getting into the steampunk genre. It might turn some people on to, you know, reading the Pat O'Malley series. They're just brief, you know, plot summary.
Very short, right?
Very short. One sentence.
Okay, that's perfect. Go.
Okay, so there are four mysteries that I have coming up. I've already written a trilogy. But the first one is going to be O'Malley. He's my detective hero. And he has a crew. And he has to face off in this mystery with a steam-powered submarine that's pirating commercial shipping off the coast of New York City. And then the second book is going to have Tammany Hall and this political organization is backing a new venture called Go West. But the winners of the lottery are supposed to be paid to become pioneers in the Wild West. But instead, O'Malley discovers that the winners are being sent on much more dangerous pioneering missions into the future. And the third one is Mazakin, which are half angel, half human from Judaic folklore. Seth Mergenthaler, he's been in the second and third novels. He says that his father has returned from the dead. But O'Malley must find out whether Dr. Arthur Mergenthaler is real or if he is a clone created by the mysterious Steam City Pirates who now live beneath New York City and obviously
like
develop cloning.
Sounds like a rock group, the Steam City Pirates.
Steam City Pirates. I can see the people in their costumes, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Already.
I don't know. This just popped into my head when you said that.
A music group. Anyway.
You have that as a side thing.
That's right. Yeah, in fact, I put a Spotify playlist on my book's website, you know, so people can listen to the latest playlist for steampunk. Anyway, and then the fourth one is a steam-powered sex machine. Now, how I ever got that into my head, I don't know. I guess writing about the prostitution thing. But this sex machine is taking over Madam Becky Charming's business. However, when this machine starts killing its customers, Pat O'Malley must step in to solve the case. So there are four mysteries on tap for my series. So if readers have suggestions or ideas that they might have for a new Pat O'Malley steampunk mystery, then please, you know, email me or visit the website. It's contempinstruct.com/forevermore.
Okay. Also, we'll put more information when I do my blog on Friday, so we'll have all your website information on that blog. So
cool.
Okay, so now what do you want people to take away from those, your series? What is that you like, that kernel?
I think the idea that learning history can be fun, and because I mix actual historical characters, I do a lot of research on getting the details right. You know, the at least the part where I'm at, the setting in the 1860s and so forth. And then you have the fantastic element, you know, of course. But I like to mix both. So I think readers can take away from my books a feeling of knowing the 1860s and what it was really like, as well as the fun of, you know, if a science fiction fantasy story.
And what is your, how do you feel, what is your satisfaction from completing your latest book?
I don't know. I think with the third novel, Jane the Grabber, I keep calling her Joan, I don't know, Joan Rivers maybe, whatever. Jane the Grabber. The satisfaction was creating this kind of character who's more ominous and out off stage, and letting the reader imagine what she's like more than, because I just show her in the prologue very briefly. I mean, she's in a scene, but I like that ominous feeling, and then hitting them at the end, I felt very satisfied, at least as a reader slash author, of showing her true nature, so to speak, at the end. And I expect, you know, maybe the readers will be satisfied of the build-up, you know, the kind of subtle build-up to this kind of steampunk villain. She turns out to be villainess, if that's a word.
Well, they make it one. I don't know if it actually is literally a word. Because
I don't think it is. Yeah, I don't think it's a sexist.
They make it one in different movies and TV shows. The villainess, see you next week, come in. And
it's actually sexist, if you stop and think about it. Cause,
yeah.
You know, who has, you know, I would say probably it's more masculine if you want to look at the real villains throughout history. But I mean, the ones that cause
there's
the most damage.
There's some pretty bad villains that are female, too.
That's true. But I don't, you know, Hitler, you know, Stalin,
yeah.
Come on, you know, millions. It's like, how do you compete?
Well, I don't know. There's a few.
Yeah.
The one who's the traitor, I forgot.
Mata Hari.
Blanked out. I can see her, but I couldn't think of her name. Mata Hari wasn't exactly a sweetheart.
No, that's true. Yeah, there's some. I mean, for intrinsic evil, if they weren't living in a patriarchal society and they were given the power, they would have probably been just as evil as any of those dictators.
Yep. I think, you know, I think there are people that are as good and there's people as bad as no in between, you know.
Right.
It's just what's inside the person. It doesn't matter
what
you are.
Yeah, I think that's what we authors kind of bring to the table, too. You know, we're able to make people, you know, who might at first glance not seem to be that evil. You know, Hannah Arendt was an excellent author. She talked about the banality of evil, you know, that a lot of the Nazis were just like next door neighbors, you know, folks you wouldn't pick out of a crowd to be really, you know, what they were. And I think that's what scares me the most, you know.
Yeah,
it's kind of
true. It's very true. Believe it or not, we are at the end of our interview. It just went really fast.
Yeah, it was fun.
Thank you. I'd like my live audience, thank Jim, for a great interview. Next week, we are going to have Mitzi Sorrento. She has a book called Normal for Norfolk. It is the Lioness Tea Bear Chronicles, which sounds really cute. Thank you, Jim, for a great interview.
Thank you very much for being an excellent hostess, and good luck with your work.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Thank you.